Good afternoon. Gathered members of the Ministerial Conference in Berry Street, I'm Kate Walker, your new scribe. By way of introduction, I've always wanted to be Alice Blair Wesley. So I'm particularly delighted to follow in her footsteps, as well as Paul Sprechter, Rudy Nemser, and dozens of other scribes over a long and gilded history. I hope to rise to Alice's standards, as well as my other predecessors. And for those of you who do not know Alice Blair Wesley, she has impressed us with her intellect, her wry sense of humor. She tells it like it is. And she is an all-around expert on love and covenant. Now, I do feel compelled to confide that there may be around 100 people in the Ohio Meadville District who think I am Alice Blair Wesley. In the winter of 2008, our colleague Joan Van Beesler was being installed as the new district executive. And with less than 2 hours to the grand evening being held at First Unitarian Pittsburgh, she received word that due to a snowstorm, Alice Blair Wesley, who was to deliver the charge to the district, was stuck in an airport far, far away from Pittsburgh. Joan looked at me. She called in a chip that I owed her. With the frantic assistance of colleagues Kathleen Rowlands and Wayne Arneson, I managed to pull together a charge deemed of some value. And at the appointed time of the charge, I jumped up and poured forth my wisdom to the gathered assembly of the Ohio Meadville District. And seeing the smiles and hearing the laughs at all the appropriate times, I felt satisfied and I plopped down in my seat next to Mark Bellatini, who took compassion on me and whispered, "That was brilliant." It was only later, during the reception, as people were thanking me for my pointed message and addressing me as Alice, that I realized I never introduced myself as someone other than the person listed on the program. So for a few, I am Alice Blair Wesley, and I have done nothing to correct that view. So, for those of you who are missing Alice, I am too. I get it. For now, I remain Kate Walker, your new scribe, duly elected by the Executive Committee of the Ministerial Conference in Berry Street, and I share this story so that you know that if I owe you anything, you can count on it. But it also does show my deep commitment to this institution and to the institutions and the values of love and covenant. The scribe convenes the Executive Committee of the Ministerial Conference in Berry Street, which in turn is charged with nominating the essayist. The scribe also convenes and presides over this body of people known as the members of the Ministerial Conference in Berry Street. You are members by virtue of you showing up today. Now, we have been here gathered since May 30th of 1820, except for 1 year in World War II. Now, seeing as my new duties as scribe includes the earnest care of ecclesiastical history, I turned to one of our previous essayists for wisdom, and I found in the records an essay titled, oddly, Ecclesiastical History, by Dr. Alvin Lampson, May 25th of 1842. Dr. Lampson began his essay with, quote, "The topic is not one of my own selection, nor can I hope to invest it with any attractions." Ecclesiastical history, he says, I believe, is not a favorite study with the profession, nor is there any department of human knowledge more neglected by the public. I realized I was not off to a good start. With a kindle of hope, I read on. As he said, I am not much surprised that it is so. The subject is usually treated as dry, dull, and repulsive in the extreme. Dr. Lamson thus far has not inspired me. But I read on, hope diminishing. As he lambasted, ecclesiastical history is being clouded by passion and prejudice, and then turned to the many disgusting views of human nature. Let me stop here. Let me just say that the source of my new wisdom continued on with such words as melancholy perversion, weakness, saddest aberrations of intellect, tyrannies, and follies, and I was still only on the third paragraph. With considerable care, Dr. Lamson lays out his argument for the preacher's interest in and good care of ecclesiastical history, as well as Christian history. His argument is based on the proposition that in addition to the above depravity, preachers carry honor and truth, and they can never be destroyed. Quote, if it sometimes canonizes falsehood, in its further progress, it unmasks it and shows us that the divinities we worship are but painted wood. We bow to it not as time corrupter, but time the purifier. And he ends with the manifestations of the religious element in our nature and the revelations of truth to the human soul are as old as the existence of man on earth. And there is no fact connected with their history which may not have its use and which will not have its use with the reflecting mind, often in a manner least anticipated. End quote. My wisdom gained. As scribe, I pledged to ensure the ecclesiastical history of the ministerial conference in Berry Street. I've been warned I will be very possessive of it. In order for us to hear the clouded passions and prejudice, our weaknesses, our tyrannies, and our follies, and so that we can recognize history's reminder that honor and truth are long established, and to the delight of the reflecting mind, a source of constant surprise. I now declare the 195th Ministerial Conference in Berry Street in session. The members of the Executive Committee of the Ministerial Conference in Berry Street, Barbara Queeman, Manish Misra Marzetti Kumar is behind me, and outgoing member Deborah Pope Lance. Unfortunately, she could not be with us this year, and tradition has it that the outgoing member, Deborah, will offer the prayer. However, Manish has graciously offered to offer it in her absence.
Good afternoon, colleagues, friends, and gathered members of the Ministerial Conference at Berry Street. I want to invite you in this post-lunch session to take just a minute to center yourselves, ground yourselves, find that place of inner stillness, inner wisdom within each of your hearts as we pray. Spirit of love, Spirit of life, dear God, as we gather this afternoon, each holding dear the values of our faith, may we ground ourselves in the ages-old tradition of this conference, the goal of strengthening liberal religion through open dialogue. Committed to that purpose, may we be increasingly aware of orthodoxies and patterns that do not serve us, the ways in which we may be keeping ourselves from being all that you mean for us to be. Recognizing that the only way past that which does not serve is through growth and evolution, our own and that of our faith, may we find the inner stillness required to listen with an open heart and view ourselves with fresh eyes. From that heart space of receptivity, help us remember the easiness with which all of creation ebbs and flows. Help us remember that being in harmony with you, with the ground of our being, is not hard. It's not difficult. All we have to do is relax and be, just like the tree, just like the wind, just like the eagle in flight. Recalling that wisdom, may we allow the spirit of all that is to free us from any rigidity and grace our hearts with the tenderness of new understandings and possibilities. It's in this manner that we gather. It's in this manner that we pray. May it be so. Amen.
For those of you who have not been to a Berry Street, the odd ritual begins. I would like a nomination from the floor for our moderator, please.
I nominate Matthew Johnson.
Hereby closing the nominations for the moderator and taking this election by acclamation, I invite Matthew Johnson forward.
Just as long as my heart beats, I must answer yes to love. Disappointment pierced me through. Still, I kept on loving you. If they ask me what I did well, tell them I said yes to love. Or this, if you will, if I have not love, I am but a noisy gong. I am so honored to introduce my friend, our colleague, the Reverend Sean Parker Dennison. I could tell you a lot about him, that after a childhood of beauty and pain in the hills and hamlets of Iowa, he became a Unitarian Universalist in Ames in 1992. He answered the call to ministry and moved to Berkeley in 96. The starting class that year, he reminded me this morning at Star King, included Don Southworth and Peter Morales. I could tell you that those years were a life-changing identity claiming time, as Sean became Sean, and we are glad he did. I could tell you that he was ordained in 2000 and served an interim ministry in Stockton, California, a settled ministry at South Valley Church in Salt Lake City, an interim in San Luis Obispo, and he is finishing his third year at Tree of Life Church in McHenry, Illinois, just down the road from me in Rockford, Illinois. I could and should tell you that he is a proud parent and a totally smitten granddad of two beautiful grandbabies. I could and should tell you that he is an artist and a poet, and he takes beautiful photographs and writes a daily prayer, a prayer that many of us look forward to each day. I can and should tell you that, but what I really want you to know is that if they ask what he did well, I will say he said yes to love. He loves the people in the congregations he has served, to see his joy when they come alive, to see his heartbreak when they suffer, to see him forgive them when they do wrong, especially even when the wrong is to him. He said yes to love. He loves his family and his friends and strangers he hasn't met yet and artists everywhere and all of you, our colleagues. Though some have consciously or unconsciously disappointed him, he loves them. Though some require good boundaries and distance, he loves them. Sometimes that's the best form of love, we know. He loves the spirit of life, the spirit of love, the spirit of art and creation. Though life is what life is. Each of us has our own, in our own particular way, been pierced through by disappointment. So too, my friend Sean. all of us. Yet love pulls him to a greater vision, a larger life. But it's not ego. He is no noisy gong. He is trying with grace and courageous honesty to figure out what love asks of him and of all of us. He's showing through his ministry what it might mean to walk in the ways of love, known and unknown, into a future we don't know yet. That's what he's going to talk about today. He's an inspiration to me, and I am proud to call him my friend and our colleague. This year's Berry Street essayist, the Reverend Sean Parker Dennison.
Thank you. Thank you. It's an honor to be here, to be given time and attention, two of the things that are most valuable in our culture. So thank you for offering those things to me. I have a friend who writes books. In fact, she writes a new book about every few months, and she gives them all away online. She also gives a lot of writing advice, which has come in really handy as I've prepared this essay. My friend's biggest piece of advice was, do not keep any secrets as you write. Now that's a hard piece of advice to take. And it's actually controversial in the writing world, where some authors suggest you should keep the audience hanging for as long as possible, not letting them in on the major themes or plot points or plot twists until you absolutely have to. To support her side of the argument, my friend Ksenia quotes Kurt Vonnegut's eighth rule of writing. That is, give your readers as much information as possible as soon as possible. To heck with suspense. Readers should have such complete understanding of what is going on, where and why, that they could finish the story themselves should cockroaches eat the final few pages. My friend even reveals the entire plot of one of her books in the very first sentence, which reads, Lilith Bloom had a peculiar feeling that the rose garden wanted to eat her. And so, out of respect for Ksenia, my friend, and for you, my audience, I'm going to take her advice and tell you right away, without suspense, that this essay is about failure. The title I chose, Mission Impossible, Why Failure is Not an Option, is a play on words and an attempt to be clever. But what I mean by failure is not an option is not that ministers or Unitarian Universalists or human beings cannot or should not fail. What I really mean by failure is not an option is we cannot help but fail. If our mission is big enough, we will fail. It's not an option. It's inevitable. So why should we admit to failure? Well, along with avoiding suspense, I promised myself another thing when I agreed to prepare this essay. I promised myself that I would tell the truth. No distortion, no evasion, no covering up the hard or embarrassing parts, no lies of omission, just truth. So that's why I needed to start off by telling you right away that failure is inevitable. But I need to tell you something else just as directly, and that is that we are already failing. You may be asking yourself, now why would anyone accept and admit to failure and not fight, kicking and screaming, to avoid it? Believe me, I understand the question. When I'm stressed or anxious, I will do it all by myself. And what I do will be so amazing and excellent that you will never doubt me. I call this coping mechanism hypercompetence. So truly, I do understand how hard it is to admit failure. It's hard to admit I've failed in the past, hard to admit I could fail in the future, and hardest of all to admit when I'm failing in the moment. And yet, I'm here telling you this truth. I am, and you are, and we are failing. Now, I'm not saying or proposing that we intentionally fail or engage in any kind of self-sabotage, and I'm not suggesting that we surrender all hope of success in our ministries, our congregations, and our work for the common good. The real reason I'm telling you these truths about failure is that I want to free us all, free us from the fear, the shame, and the isolation of being people who fail. As long as we fear failure, as long as we use up vast amount of energy trying to be perfect, absolutely and adamantly competent, we're not going to have the energy to be or become the relevant, passionate, responsive, and growing Unitarian Universalism that I know we want to be. As long as we're frozen in our tracks by fear, the fear that we might fail, or more accurately, the fear that someone might find out that we fail, we're stuck thinking small, making only the safest, perfect little plans that we already know will succeed. But I'm here to tell you that you might as well go ahead and plan to fail, because you're going to do it anyway. You already are. There's another reason to admit failure. Study after study that measures the priorities of the mostly younger demographic that we hope to attract to our congregations are reporting this major shift. People are no longer swayed and impressed by knowledge. They don't really care about having big truths explained to them in sermons. They no longer turn to ministers for answers to religious or spiritual questions. They turn to Google. So we're all now inundated with information, most of which is meant to manipulate us into clicking or tweeting or posting or buying something. We don't need more information anymore. And more and more of us don't trust the sources of information we already have. So instead of information, people are looking for ways to sort through it, to determine what's helpful and relevant and worth remembering, worth risking for. And the way they're determining that, and who can help with that, is by looking for authenticity. You'll see 63,800,000 hits for studies on authenticity. People in design and tourism and advertising and event planning and the culinary arts are all trying to appear more authentic. You heard that? They're trying to appear more authentic. In other words, they're faking it. Their product or their brand or their restaurant or their toothpaste is best because it's the most sincere and down-to-earth and authentic, because that's what sells. All of this means that people are becoming incredibly sensitive to pretense. They distrust slick, glossy packaging. They abhor insincerity. They like flaws. It seems the next generation of churchgoers, if there is to be one, will not care so much about the learned ministry as they will about the authentic one. If we're going to be relevant, we have to be real. And that means admitting that we fail. Not only that we might fail, or could possibly fail, or have a great 10-point philosophical understanding of failure, but that we do fail. Right now, right here, we're already failing. And we are failing. I don't take that or say that lightly. Because frankly, the ways in which we're failing break my heart. I've spent at least some time every day for the past few years considering leaving Unitarian Universalism and ministry. Not because I'm bitter or angry that others have failed me. Not because I doubt myself or my ability to be a good minister. I consider leaving the ministry because my heart is constantly breaking. Broken so relentlessly that it can't even begin to heal before it's broken again. Maybe a story will help. Once upon a time, when the internet was still shiny and new, and there were no blogs, but only live journals and Usenet groups, an independent Baptist minister who called himself Real Life Preacher, you gotta imagine a carnival barker yelling, "I got your Real Life Preacher right here." He began writing about ministry and theology and life. I found him online and I was fascinated. I watched his fame and his community grow. He moved his writing to its own blog domain, signed a book contract, and added a chat room where a motley interfaith crew began hanging out. He was, by all accounts, one of the earliest internet success stories. Eventually, Real Life Preacher and I became friends, real life friends. Not just the, "Oh, hi, I know you from the internet" kind, but "I call you when my son is in jail or my teenage daughter is pregnant" friends. We also had ministry in common and became the kind of friends who understand the life of a minister in a rascally, independent congregation. The kind of friends who don't get upset when those long pauses happen, those long silences fall between us, or when we can't really meet face to face. And then about 3 years ago, Real Life Preacher left the ministry. And even though I knew he'd been struggling for a while, I was shocked. I read all the explanations he posted, picked up the phone and called him to hear him say the words himself, but I was still confused, and truthfully, I was scared. This friend and colleague who meant so much to me, whose stories and encouragement and support got me through some of the hardest times in my life, he just quit. And he was happy about it, or at least relieved. I didn't have a chance to sit down with him face to face and ask him about his decision until this past November, when I went to Texas over Thanksgiving for some self-care and healing with a dear colleague. My host graciously allowed me to invite Real Life Preacher to join us at the family tamalada, where we would all get our hands and our shirts dirty and our bellies full while we stocked the freezer with tamales for Christmas. It was then, after hours of rolling and steaming and packing up tamales, that I finally had the chance to sit down with Real Life Preacher and ask, "Tell me, really, Preacher, really, why did you leave the ministry? I mean, that the real reason. I need to know. The one you don't just tell everybody. I really need to know." As I remember it, he was silent for a minute. the kind of silence that happens when you know you're going to say something so true that it could change everything. And then he told me. And what he told me has been like a sore spot in my heart. You know, like a broken tooth that you probe over and over again, alternately repelled and fascinated by the pain. He told me I had to leave the ministry because I could no longer serve the overserved. Ouch. I could no longer serve the overserved. I'll admit that from time to time as I prepared this essay, I imagined recounting every way that, in my perception, Unitarian Universalism has missed its mark. But I realized as I listened to my friend that all the disappointments that I've been carrying around and trying to ignore, all the hurt I feel when I'd wanted better for myself or my congregation or my faith tradition, all the weariness from being singled out as a role model or a poster child because of what I am and not who I am, all the sadness that makes me wonder daily if I can bear to continue my calling, it's all there. In that sentence, I could no longer bear to serve the overserved. He named in 7 words the sum total of what I'm calling our failure. It's important to note that this failure is only in part a failure of individuals. It's far more the failure of systems, and the particular failure of privilege. We've inherited a tradition and a culture that have been aligned with the overserved, the privileged, the powerful. Of course, this privilege and power are not personally true for all of us, and for the majority of us, it's only true in some of the times and spaces of our lives. That as a whole, the culture that defines us is one of privilege. It's also true that only half of our name and history are really aligned with this social privilege. But as is often true when mergers happen, the culture with the more practice being in power becomes dominant. And so we're more like our Unitarian ancestors than we are like our Universalist ones. We've inherited this system of expectations and habits and beliefs about ourselves and our world that reflect this pattern of power and privilege. Whether we like it or not, whether we notice it or not, whether it serves us or not, this is our position, and we're not alone. Walter Brueggemann wrote an entire book for those of us who share this position. He called it Prayers for a Privileged People. And in it are these words. We are a people of privilege and entitlement. We are among the haves. We have education, connection, power, and wealth. Too often, we're indulgent and self-sufficient consumers. We speak of our achievements and accomplishments. Sometimes we offer God liturgies of disregard, litanies of selves made too big. But we hear faint reminders of a better way. So we're part of a system that is steeped in habits of privilege. These habits become part of us. We internalize and replicate them without conscious thought. And these patterns we've inherited are the biggest part of how we're failing. While privilege confers power and status and opportunity, it also prescribes certain kinds of awareness and relationships. The very basis of privilege is this notion that some people are more worthy than others. that their ideas and needs and very existence is more important. If you ask any one of us, we'll tell you this isn't true, that all people are equally worthy. But the system is insidious and persistent, and it teaches us to continually judge and rank people. And there's really only one powerful criterion we use to make those judgments: how close any one of us is to a specific ideal of perfection. Now, we actually all know what perfection is. Perfection is young. It is white. It is male. It is healthy and able-bodied. It's thin. It's athletic. Perfection is heterosexual. It's Christian. It's economically comfortable. Each and every one of us is and has been measured against this ideal, and we're all taught to measure each other as well. And when any one of us is judged to be lacking, it's never the fault of the system or the standards. It's always the fault of the individual who just didn't measure up. According to the system, people who do not measure up are less important, less worthy, and just matter less. We've seen in so many ways over the past few weeks and months this ideology at its most extreme. We've seen what happens when people believe that some lives matter more than others. We've seen violence, incarceration, deportation, exile, homelessness, terrorism, poverty. And even as we cringe at those things, we find we too have absorbed that mental organizational chart, the way of looking at the world, ourselves, and each other. And in another one of its big tricks, the closer we are to the ideal, the less likely we are to even notice the whole scheme. We think it's just the way things are. And that helps the scheme replicate itself in every interaction, every Facebook post, every time we decide whether or not to take a risk, talk to a stranger, clutch our purse, or lock our doors. The system is cunning and crafty, and it manages to infiltrate our thoughts and our communities so fully that no one is immune. And we employ it towards others or towards ourselves. We've seen the religious right be brutal and vocal in their judgments. They openly blame the ills of society, human tragedies, and natural disasters on people they believe to be impure and imperfect. But they're actually not alone. I'm noticing the increasing use of internet shaming on all sides, from publishing the names and addresses of those accused of wasting water to a kind of vicious joy at calling out the mistakes and excesses of celebrities. Yes, people say and do stupid, unkind, and unjust things. And yes, we should and can critique them. But more and more, I see people demanding perfection, ideological and behavioral purity, in a way that I recognize. And when someone's judged to be problematic, I see a new but very familiar shaming and shunning happening. All of this is just another way the hierarchy of perfection exerts its influence, punishing mistakes and failures, and amplifying the message of hierarchy and inequality. Ultimately, this obsession with who is good enough or pure enough or right enough, dehumanizes all of us. It dehumanizes the ones being judged and rejected, but also the ones doing the judging, who must distance themselves from their own humanity and the others. This culture of judgment destroys human connection and communities, and it punishes mistakes and failures while demanding perfection. So not only have we learned and been taught to idolize the myth of perfection, but we become trained to fear difference, to fear making mistakes, to fear being or becoming the imperfect one. Because we've internalized this fear, no matter how near or far we are actually to the impossible ideal, we must constantly cover up the parts of ourselves that don't measure up. So we live with this constant anxiety that to be judged less than perfect means we are therefore less worthy. This system has taught us that our value comes from our proximity to perfection. No wonder we fear failure. The fear of failure keeps us isolated, but it can also incapacitate us. Even if we believe and yearn to contradict the system and fight the resulting oppression and colonialism, we're often immobilized by the fear that we cannot or will not succeed. Dr. Crystal Marie Fleming, assistant professor of sociology and Africana studies at Stony Brook University, made this point powerfully clear on Twitter this week when she reminded us of this. We must be willing to challenge racial oppression without reaching for or lapsing into liberal fairy tales about ending racism. Yeah. We can't allow the system to scare us into inaction, keeping us petrified and frozen because we might fail, and therefore we allow the oppression to continue unchallenged. Walter Brueggemann's poem ended with the words, "But we hear faint reminders of a better way." This better way, I think, perhaps, is the real reason religion exists at all, and why it too is constantly failing and being reformed. A responsible and mature faith dethrones us from the pretense of perfection. And it accepts that we will fail, that we are already failing. Ironically, it's the fear of failure that causes us to fail. Because we fear failing, we are failing. The terrible effect of a system that constantly judges us and evaluates our every action and shames us for not being perfect is that we begin to limit ourselves. We stop dreaming big. We insist on realism and practicality in all of our planning. We begin to pride ourselves in being dispassionate. We rely on what we already know, information rather than inspiration. We seek advice from people who we feel understand the limits of our resources and capacity. We dismiss and defend ourselves from the people who urge us to do more and dream bigger. We may even begin to shame people with big ideas, branding them troublemakers or fools. How can they ask such irrational, illogical, or unrealistic things of us? And we do all this, which creates conflict and division in our community, because we're afraid, but also because we're tired uninspired, burned out. You see, without vision, you've heard this, the people perish. And people who feel as if they're perishing and worry that their faith tradition is perishing are all too tempted to trade the work of creating paradise on earth for a strategic plan with a goal of 10 new congregations in 5 years. Or just one pledge drive that will actually balance the budget. This is how we fail. Our vision and our mission become safe and small. I long for Unitarian Universalists to be claimed by a mission impossible. I don't mean write a mission statement. I don't even mean create a mission. I mean be claimed by a mission so big that it startles and scares us. Like this congregation, a Methodist congregation in my hometown, that put up a banner that simply said, "We feed the hungry." And they did. They opened a soup kitchen, a food pantry, an after-school program. They also fed the hungry by gathering for spiritual sustenance, building relationships that broke through isolation so they could truly begin to love their neighbors as themselves. And the congregation grew and thrived and had to expand their building to hold everything they needed to live their mission. So I long for us to be claimed by a mission that's bold and huge and daring. Let me give it a shot. Maybe our mission could be Unitarian Universalists show up. Wherever there's a need, a crisis, a cry for justice, or a supportive presence, Unitarian Universalists would show up. We're starting to practice this. We wouldn't have to lead. That's really important. Thank you. We wouldn't have to plan long-term strategies. We just show up wherever we're needed or whenever we're asked. Imagine that we had a reputation that sounded like, "Oh, you need someone to clean up that creek bed over there, or march in that pride parade, or protest injustice, or protect Muslim worshipers at prayer? Call the Unitarian Universalists. They show up." I'm a firm believer that what will save us, or will at least increase our odds of being a relevant and growing movement, is a mission so grand, so big that it's impossible. Call it creating heaven on earth, or building beloved community, or repairing the world. It's something so audacious that it demands that we lay aside our culture of caution, our desire to prove our efficacy, and our fear of failure. Our mission would be so big and have such a claim upon us that even if we messed up, we'd keep trying. Because no matter how big or our mission is, we still wouldn't be perfect. We might show up when we weren't really needed. We would probably say or do the wrong thing in an unfamiliar situation. Or maybe, we would fail to show up when our presence would have made a difference. And we'd have to find a way to admit failure, make amends, recommit ourselves to our mission, and try again. I'm okay with that. Because by trying to live up to our impossible mission, we would learn and grow, and we would be in the places where we were needed. And we'd learn a new kind of courage, a new way of being brave. Neil Gaiman, who's a writer and creator of many things, gave a commencement speech that was later published as a book. In it, he urges, I hope you'll make mistakes. If you're making mistakes, it means you're out there doing something. Make interesting, amazing, glorious, fantastic mistakes. Break rules. Leave the world more interesting for you being there. Make good art. I hear something in Mr. Gaiman's words that inspires me to that new kind of courage, that new way of being brave. If our congregations are going to be relevant, I think we have to lead the way, especially us ministers. We have to lead without, or at least in spite of, the fear of failure. Perhaps we can learn some of this by reconnecting with the muses, playful and dangerous partners that they are. Art and spirit are close kin, the only two realms in which people talk openly about inspiration, about being claimed by the beauty of a thing or a cause or an idea. For centuries, if you wanted to see art, you went to a cathedral or a temple or a mosque. You might walk through gardens that were made to resemble paradise on earth, or be bathed in light filtering through stories told in glass. For millennia, people understood art to be a gateway to spirit, and spirit to be at work in art. It's only in the past few centuries, as industry and capital have begun to determine what has value, that art's been demoted to an avocation, a hobby. When I was planning my most recent project, Cabaret Church, we used a quote by Jennifer Yane as our motto. Art is spirituality in drag. It might have made people laugh, but I hope it made them think too. Art and spirituality are so deeply connected, and I think we have a lot to gain by reclaiming not just a connection to art, but a sense of ourselves as artists and the work of ministry as art. Another story. The end of my first year at my current congregation, Tree of Life, it was clear to me that I was ministering to a community of artists. Our 140-member congregation has a 30-member choir that honestly can sing anything. Our awesome music director, name check to Tom Steffens, takes every idea that I come up with and somehow makes it awesome. This year, just to name a few, they sang Leonard Cohen's anthem, my favorite gospel song, The Storm is Passing Over, and REM's Everybody Hurts. Yeah, I'm bragging. It's true. But it's not just music. I have actors and sculptors and fabric artists and painters and poets and glass artists. I can't think actually of anyone in my congregation, I really tried, who doesn't make art. Even the chair of my endowment trustees plays the banjo at our coffee house. And he's good. One Sunday after the service, I was talking with a few board members, and I spontaneously asked them this question. So when I say minister, what image comes to mind? Their list was unsurprising. He's tall and thin, in his mid-50s, has gray hair and a beard, wears black, and is very serious. Then I just asked, what about when I say artist? What do you imagine then? Oh, she's young. She has blue hair and tattoos, and she wears colorful, funky clothes, and she's lively and unique and fun. As I observed these long-term members of my congregation, it wasn't actually the answers they were giving, but the way they gave them that caught my attention. They spoke with joy, enthusiasm, and heart. When I pointed that out, the change of energy in the room, We actually agreed right then and there that we were going to experiment with trading that mental image of the minister for that of artist. They laughed, and they said to me, "Now you're going to dye your hair blue, aren't you?" And I said, "Maybe." And the chair of the board said, "Good." And something began to shift. And we began to claim art as part of our mission. And it began to change us. Later in the year, when I said at a planning meeting, "You know, I really probably should teach a class on UU history," they were savvy enough to ask, "Is that your serious-minded minister all in black showing up? What do you really want to teach?" And when I answered, "Well, there's this poetry class I've taught a couple of times." And they said, "That. Teach that." And I did. 9 women signed up for the class. 4 of them were already leaders in the congregation. 2 came because they wanted to get to know people better. A mom and a daughter decided to take the class together. And the 9th woman was new. She'd been on our mailing list because she'd once attended a documentary film we'd shown. That very week, her therapist had encouraged her to start a writing practice. And so she saw our poetry class and signed up. As we introduced ourselves at the first meeting, she mentioned that she attended a local evangelical megachurch. The next week, the writing assignment was write a poem that tells a very short story. When it came time for the class to begin to share, the newcomer blurted out, "I'm really terrified to read this. I've been terrified all day. Please, can I go first?" Absolutely. Everybody agreed, some with much relief. And she introduced her poem by telling us that she had gone into counseling because her marriage was abusive, and she was wrestling with what to do. She then read the most honest and painfully beautiful poem telling a story of power and control that was deeply personal, but also one that anyone who'd known abuse would find familiar. In that moment, that class became more than a bunch of people who wanted to experiment with writing poetry. We were claimed by a mission, the most fundamental mission of art, the mission of truth-telling. From that moment, none of us could share a single poem that pretended to be something it was not. We bonded into a community that could tell and hear truth. More than that, the Unitarian Universalists in the class gained, seemingly instantaneously, the ability to interpret and accept words spoken in a language of faith that they themselves had rejected. No one felt the need to correct her when she said, "God bless you," or dismiss her when she said, "Praise the Lord." The mission of truth-telling was too important. About halfway through the class, she found the courage to move into a local shelter. It was hard for her to be there, and she kept writing poems, and we kept listening without judgment and without correction. Her poems told her story, and we learned the terrifying truth of the danger she was in. We heard how the leaders of her church told her to go home, to have faith, to pray. We heard what she couldn't tell them, that she'd locked his guns in the trunk of her car because she was afraid he would kill her while she slept. We held her, and we held her truth, and we shared a profound, artful, and spiritual community. She didn't become Unitarian Universalist. And like many women in her position, she struggled, returned home, left again. Her road to freedom and safety will likely continue to be bumpy, but her willingness to be honest made it possible for all of us to set aside our facade of perfectionism and connect around our common, flawed humanity. Together we witness two things: the value of her life and each life, no matter how far from perfect, and the power of art in spiritual community to affirm that value and beauty. In this small circle of truth tellers, she could see herself, flaws and all, through our eyes, and ultimately through our theology, a theology in which eternal, all-embracing love would never, ever let her go. She didn't become Unitarian Universalist, but she knows we're here. She knows there's a religious community that doesn't believe she's being punished, doesn't blame her for the abuse, and will not abandon her for being human. Art is healing. Making good art is more than paint on canvas, or a moving melody line, or a beautiful turn of phrase. Making good art is opening our hearts, our whole beings, to the emotion, inspiration, pain, and courage of being alive. Making good art demands that we let go and allow ourselves to be claimed by something bigger than our egos, something bigger than our fear. Making good art means being willing to face the inevitable messes and mistakes and be brave. When we do this, we sometimes succeed in things we never even managed to imagine. Like many of you, I do something now and then that terrifies me just a little bit. I put a sermon up for sale at the annual fundraising auction. The winning bidder gets to determine the subject of the sermon, and I'm always a little bit afraid that the buyer will try to stump me by picking a subject they know I know nothing about. I have had a couple of close calls: a sermon on near-death experiences, and one called "You Too Can Be a Libertarian." But even more fascinating than the possible trickster sermons is the one topic that's come up more regularly than any other. At least four times, four of the sermons that people have asked me to preach have been willing to pay me to preach, have been on forgiveness. As Unitarian Universalists, we don't start our religious story with predestined shame or mutually assured damnation. And I am thankful for that. Yet sometimes I fear we've missed the theological point. Just because we don't believe in original sin doesn't mean we're perfect. And when the inevitable pain and disappointment come, when people fail us, we fail ourselves and each other, we find ourselves deeply in need of the theologies and practices of forgiveness. And yet, our Unitarian Universalist principles and purposes don't mention it. We have no season of forgiveness, no ritual of repentance, no confessional. There's promise in our universalism, but we have yet to articulate much more than a vague understanding that somehow it's possible for us to be reconciled, to return to right relationship, no matter how much we've failed. We make mistakes, big, sometimes huge, painful, messy ones, and we feel the consequences of the mistakes of others. And we need theologies of forgiveness, ways to make things right. Without them, we're stuck, doomed to this hard-hearted pretense of perfection. Our colleague, Reverend Marvin Lavenhar, named something in a sermon a few years ago that I haven't forgotten. He said, our mistake, One mistake we often make is trying to lead with our strengths rather than our heartbreak. Thank you, Marlon, for naming that so clearly. What we need to do, if our movement is going to resonate with the nuns or the duns we hear so much about, is lead with our heartbreak, even with our failure. We need to counter the culture of purity and perfectionism with a universalist theology of love and with new practices that teach us that we will not be rejected, but can find our way back when we fail. Failure is not easy. If I've made light of it in any way, I am truly sorry. Even small failures can be terribly embarrassing, and big failures can be devastating. So when I ask us to embrace failure and forgiveness, I'm asking us to do something huge and radical. Forgiveness is not easy either. Despite the pop culture books and memes with pretty pictures and promises, forgiveness is hard spiritual work. Educator and feminist bell hooks, who I believe is one of the greatest thinkers in recent times, says this: "For me, forgiveness and compassion are always linked. How do we hold people accountable for wrongdoing, and yet at the same time remain in touch with their humanity enough to believe in their capacity to be transformed?" I think that's what forgiveness asks us to do. It's actually something, bell hooks has named something we've needed for a very long time. It's the other side of our theology of covenant, the acknowledgement that we have indeed broken our vows 1,000 times. Only when we begin to form practices that help us live into this theology can we stop replicating the systems that divide and destroy, that break hearts and threaten to break the whole world. I'm not saying we can tell people how and when to forgive. I am saying that we must articulate something about forgiveness in order to truly live in to our own covenants. To ask for forgiveness or to offer it is a struggle every time, because it's our relationships that bear the brunt of our imperfection, and sometimes those relationships cannot bear the strain. Sometimes our hearts break. Yet, if we can offer ourselves and each other and the world theologies and practices and rituals of forgiveness that are truly worthy of our ancestors and their daring vision of love that will not let a single one of us go, we will begin to heal what is broken. Those in our movement who are urging us to become more missional, to become claimed by a mission rather than expecting people to be attracted to a Unitarian Universalism because we're so awesome, they ask a question that I have been grappling with for, well, ever since I first heard it. For whom does your heart break? There's so many possible answers, and each could free us from worrying that we must be saved by our competence, by achieving perfection. Each one of those answers encourages us to admit that while we've been good at articulating covenants, we keep failing at living them out. For whom does your heart break? I told you in the beginning of this essay that I hoped that by acknowledging our failure, we might discover a kind of freedom, a freedom to be fully human, to be honest and stop trying to convince ourselves and our congregations or God that we're perfect. This radical act of admitting that we fail, of casting off the addiction to perfection that is rooted in systems of empire and privilege. That's what's claimed me. When I imagine all of us claimed by this mission, I find that my heart and my faith and my hope for this world do begin to heal. And it makes me want to stay. Author and educator Parker Palmer wrote words that have sustained me through the times of near despair. He says, "Wholeness does not mean perfection. It means embracing brokenness as an integral part of life. Knowing this gives me hope that human wholeness, mine, yours, ours, need not be a utopian dream if we can use devastation as a seedbed for new life." That's my hope, that we can use devastation, failure, heartbreak, brokenness as the seedbed for a new, growing, and alive Unitarian Universalism. That we will take up the work that lies before us to refuse to be hardened by the constant demand for perfection, to create tools of compassion that can help us forgive ourselves and each other, and to make good art of our lives and our ministries. Good, messy, imperfect, and beautiful art. May it be so. May we be the ones that make it so. Amen, ashe, and blessed be.
Sean has chosen two responders. Meg Riley.
Thank you. Can you hear me okay? Is that good? All right. Thanks for asking me, Sean. I think that will spark a lot of collegial conversations. I believe that Sean asked me to respond today because he knows that I'm good at failing. About the time he was beginning to buckle down seriously on this talk, I told him that I'd signed up for something called Rejection Boot Camp. It was a 100-day adventure that I signed up for online with a guy named Jia Jiang. Each day, Jia Jiang would give us a specific assignment, either that we would ask for something that was likely to be met with the answer no, or that we would do something which would be very annoying and be met with repulsion or rejection. Now, for those of us who have teenage children or who are ministers, this boot camp might seem redundant. But I wanted to see if getting rejected in a structured way would build my resilience. CLF's theme of the month was courage, and I wanted to see if this would help build courage. And besides, it was February in Minnesota, and we get desperate. I quit long before 100 days was over, partly because I have the attention span of a gnat, but partly because so many of the tasks that Jia Jiang asked us to do involved asking low-wage workers for things. Jia Jiang is a young immigrant from China. I saw that while it might be very daring for him to ask for things, to ask, "Can I ride along with you while you deliver a pizza? Can I see the back of your grocery store? Will you sing happy birthday to me in this restaurant even though it's not my birthday? Can I have a piece of gum? Because of my social location as an older white middle-class woman, these requests and many more were met with a bewildered, okay. All of those requests I just named and many more got a yes. And the truth was, I didn't have time to ride in pizza delivery vans and see the backs of stores. And every day I felt like I was harassing already stressed out workers. And soon the aforementioned teenager I live with told me I was not allowed to ask another low-wage worker for another thing in this person's presence. And it was winter in Minnesota, and there weren't that many people at the dog park to harangue, and so I gradually stopped rejection therapy, unless the ask of the day really intrigued me. For instance, offering to give people money on the street is a really interesting experiment in rejection therapy, because people look horrified and say no when you try to give it to them. But though I dropped out, it did build resilience, and it built a lot bigger space for me to walk around in very appropriate Minnesota. It also gave me a lot more awareness about the privilege that I walk around with, because what I could see eventually is that the same energy I had for rejection therapy moved into two different directions. One is that I've been part of starting a local chapter of Surge, Showing Up for Racial Justice, a white allies group. If you want to experience daily structured rejection, talk to white people about racism. Now, there is a rejection therapy worthy of time and attention. My post-boot camp challenge to myself has been to bring up racism in all white environments, to say out loud the kinds of things I think as I continue to wake up consistently to the fact that I'm white, not sometimes when I'm thinking about it, but actually all the time. So just one example, I took a refresher class for drivers over 55 to get a discount on insurance, and I said, at one point I said, well, you know, but people of color in Minnesota really have to drive very differently than white people because police stop you differently. Talk about rejection therapy. The teacher was furious, and he started prefacing almost every sentence for about an hour. Black, white, or Chinese, it doesn't matter. Black, white, or Chinese, it doesn't matter. And I thought, well, it's clearly mattering in this room now. Call it victory. Initiating these conversations, expecting rejection, allows me the freedom to cross boundaries of what is called socially acceptable. Because let's face it, what is called socially acceptable is oppression of all kinds. Yeah. The other place I went after rejection therapy, and Don Southworth says I'm part of a trend in this way of ministers, was to an improv class. Improv is completely about saying yes. And I noticed that doing improv builds resilience to failure too, because my yeses can move me out into the big open sky or ocean, or sometimes they take me just a little boring cul-de-sacs. And I do all of this in front of my classmates. The yeses that take me to cul-de-sacs rather than all the way out usually occur because I get too involved with the role I've been assigned for my character. When I'm thinking, well, what would a 15th century pirate say now? It really can stop creativity right now, there. The yeses that take me out bigger when I ground myself completely in the relationships with the people that I'm with and go with them and say yes to them no matter what is going on. Whatever they ask for, whatever they tell me about myself, I say yes. And so, Sean, it is in the spirit of improv that I say this to you. You can't leave ministry. No matter... No matter how you shape what you do and where you collect money to support yourself, you are a minister. And if you quit Unitarian Universalism today, you are still so deeply in relationship with so many of us, there's really no place you could go and not take us with you. We are all grateful that Ralph Waldo Emerson left the church. what his failure brought us. Did Mr. Rogers fail as a Presbyterian minister, or did he take his message to millions? Sean, if you can't bear to overserve the privileged, if you do art in some other way, you are still one of my ministers, and you are still blessing the world with your gifts. I say it to all of us. We need to say yes to our biggest joys and passions because the world needs them. And maybe we will all walk away from the congregations, which are enclaves of privilege and control. Maybe that does need to happen. So I say this to all of us, including myself. We need to create and live a faith, call it Unitarian Universalism, that won't cease its ministry regardless of the form it takes. Many of our churches will die. We know that. The question isn't how to preserve their form. It's how to preserve the substance, how to keep our values alive in the world. I love Unitarian Universalist congregations, but I love love more. I love human liberation more than any governance policy. I love Black lives more than any compensation package. Understanding what I love, the pain and the failure that is absolutely implicit in every one of those loves, I can meet the world's yeses and nos with increasing clarity. And I use this poem so much for myself and others. William Stafford's A Ritual to Read to Each Other concludes, "For it is important that awake people be awake, or a breaking line may discourage them back to sleep. The signals we give, yes or no or maybe, should be clear. The darkness around us is deep."
Our second respondent, Ian Whitemar.
So Sean asked me to be a respondent to this paper when I'd come out to Mid-America Conference to talk about church planting, and I had just decided to leave my church because it was dying. And I said something to him that resonated, and he felt like it added to his statement, and that was, personally speaking, I have a real aversion to what often sound like glib exhortations to fail these days. You know, the ones that are coaching us not to be afraid to fail, and that are often followed by these stories of serial entrepreneurs who, you know, tried things a dozen times before they finally hit their success. And while these stories might be true, one of the things that they leave out is the pain. Failing is like a kick in the teeth. It is like a boot to the ear, and it becomes an agonizing reckoning of everything that you think you are as a person, leaving you with the terrible questions about your character. Are you failing because the market is not right? Are you failing because the support system is anemic? Or are you failing because you're just not good at this? Because there is something about you personally that just isn't right. And whatever rationalizations I made, I could never escape the relentless voice of insecurity telling me that the project, the congregation that I founded, was failing because I was not enough. And even though intellectually I knew that there was an unavoidable element to trying something new, there is nothing glib or encouraging or inspiring in these moments, because whatever the reason might be, your dream is dying, and it is excruciating to watch your dream die. Additionally, exhortations to change, to dream big, to lead the movement in new directions are often silent about some of the consequences for trying. And the biggest one for me was the loss of relationships. If you decide to commit to the risk and to venture out into new territory, inevitably you will encounter conflict with people who disagree with you. If you have the audacity of greatness, and the emphasis is on the word audacity, because vision comes only to those who, for better or worse, are audacious, you will encounter people who chafe at your audaciousness, although they will probably have another name for it. There is an orthodoxy in Unitarian Universalism, and this orthodoxy serves people. And I don't just mean congregants. I also mean ministers. Some ministers say that they want change, but in reality, they are served by the orthodoxy. They like the way we look and the way we sound and the way we act. We are this way because the majority have chosen it. We have a culture because it is made up of us. We created this culture. And when you attempt to create something else, essentially you are saying, I want something other than what the culture offers. And however harmless it is in the abstract, making vision real puts you in conflict because it confronts the orthodoxy, the often silent, unspoken, unacknowledged orthodoxy, and you step on the shadow and people react. This was my experience anyway. But if I am to own what I just said, then I must also implicate myself. I too have a shadow. And perhaps even more than that, I have a particular personality, one that works for some and not for others. Some of you just sighed because you know that personality. To believe that I could create something out of nothing, that I could walk out and hang a shingle on a corner and come say, hey, come listen to me and what I have to say. It takes faith. It takes will. It takes courage. It takes audacity, although some people may have another name for it. And in many respects, my response to your paper, Sean, and my message today may not be for the entire group of people here, of ministers gathered here, but for the few of you who are really considering the bold move of striking out on your own. Those who, for better or worse, actually take the advice and leave the known and allow yourself to be claimed by the mission of God's calling is something a bit insane. And while the lessons of my experience are far-ranging, one of the more poignant ones, I suppose, for this crowd is that some of your colleagues are going to respect you more, and some of your colleagues are going to respect you less. And some of your colleagues are going to put their name on the line for you because they believe in you. And some of your colleagues are going to talk behind your back and undermine your reputation because you chafe them in ways that are your fault and in ways that are not your fault. No congregant ever hurt me the way ministers hurt me. And no congregant ever loved me the way some of you loved me. You cannot dream big and think that everyone is going to like you. You cannot dream big and think that you are only going to become more popular, particularly if you fail, right? You are not going to have all of the same friends and more, because you are going to try to change the culture, and you will encounter the shadow of the orthodoxy, and you will step on toes, and you will have your toes stepped on. And it is incredibly painful in a small group like ours, where collegial relationships are a luxury. Lose too many, and you are alone. Try not to lose any, and you will not have the audacity that you need to be great. And at some point, you will encounter the dark night of the soul and wonder if this is even a place for you anymore. And some decide that it is not. So I am all for exhortations to dream big. Honestly, it is all that I think about. In a way, I am obsessed. In my case, I tried to start a congregation, and it failed. We had a few good years, but we failed. And I am frustrated by the impulse in people who fear that word to tell me that it wasn't a failure, that we learned things, that everyone was changed, all of which may be true, and we failed. It's okay. And personally, I'm taking a break from ministry. It cut me to ribbons to watch my dream die, and I encountered the dark night of lost collegial relationships, and I am exhausted. And I encountered those people who put their name on the line for me. And these people mean more to me than I ever could have imagined. And when I get back from my break, I will probably try to start another congregation. I don't know why you clap at sickness. It is a sickness. Right? Because it was one of the most amazing, if not the most amazing and life-giving thing that I have ever done. So, some of you are going to try to do something big. And you are going to try to change the culture, and I wish you courage. Don't stop. But understand the risk. You may be gutted. You will lose friendship. You will lose respect for people, and you will have to sit in the understanding that some people lost respect for you. But if your faith is strong, you can weather these. And then failure is just another thing. It is a terrible thing, but it is just another thing. And you will throw on some Taylor Swift, and you will try to shake it off, right? And you will ask God for help to make a way where there is no way, and you will pick up your dream off of the floor, and you will try again, because we are called to do this. And while it is hyperbolic to say that we don't care what the Orthodox thinks, because we all want to be loved and appreciated, we are more than just entrepreneurs, we are evangelists. And we know that our world is dying from a spiritual malaise, and it can only be healed by a spiritual solution. And we are charged with offering it. A failure is excruciating. Do not let anybody tell you otherwise. But to dream is life-giving. So may you have courage, may you have faith, and may you overflow with an audaciousness of a vision that is going to really upset some of your colleagues. We are called to say yes to life, and with God as our guide, we will do our very best to endure the failures as they come, so that the sunshine of the Spirit may shine ever through more beings. May it be so. Amen.
As we close this 195th Ministerial Conference in Berry Street, I want to offer my gratitude to Sean. Matthew, Meg, and Ian, thank you. I also extend gratitude to Deborah Pope-Lanz, who, as I said, is finishing her 3-year term on the executive committee, and I'm very happy to announce that Mark Morrison Reed has joined our executive committee. He says no to everything, but I got him. He said yes. So, for the last piece of news you're all waiting for, if you will please stand, next year's essayist, Gail Seavey. I declare us adjourned.